listening to the 17th episode of the Extensive Reading Podcast. I'm Jose, and with me is
Travis Past.
Yeah, you didn't think we were going to make it
to 17. No, I didn't think we were going to make it to 17, but look at us now.
Yeah. Sorry. So back to real life.
Yeah, well, thanks for joining us, as always. Last weekend, we saw a few of our guests and listeners at JEDA. Kyoto Gaidai. It was a great time.
Yeah, so Paul Goldberg and, Paul, who we interviewed for our fifth episode on X-Reading, and then Aaron Campbell,
who we talked to, and then, of course, Atsuko Takase was giving us a short lecture there, too, and it was great.
Yeah, it was great to meet Atsuko Takase in person. We talked to her on the phone. It was great to finally see her.
It was encouraging for me too, because her lecture was all in Japanese, but I felt like I was able to follow it really well.
That was meaning focused input.
Yeah, well, but it was a reminder to me of having background knowledge on the topic is a real help.
It's like close reading,
right? Yeah. So Jose kind of gave it away. And his meaning focused input joke. Today on the podcast, we do have Professor Paul Nation with us. Before we get to our interview, just a couple of housekeeping things we can address. Mm-hmm. I am proud to say we have a feed up on the podcast app.
Finally.
Finally.
And this is all thanks to Travis.
And it,
I have
it
to
was,
say.
It was a lot of work to figure out the first time. I think if I were to do it again, it'd be much easier. But anyway, if you like to listen to podcasts other than ours, you probably use some kind of application on your phone or your iPad. Search us. Search for Extensive Reading Podcast, and you can find us there and subscribe, and we'll immediately be downloaded into your application. So.
Or else you just continue to go to erpodcast.wordpress.com and we're still there.
Yep, we're still there. Our site looks a little messy right now. We will clean it up so it looks a little more organized in creating that podcast feed. I had to change a few things. But we will have a link that is just the audio link, and then a link that is the audio with the show notes that we've been doing for a long time. And we'll mark that as something like show notes, so it's clear. Mm-hmm.
So, who's our guest?
Yeah, our guest today needs no introduction because
we gave it away.
We gave it away, but we are honored to have with us Paul Nation, who is a leading contributor and voice in the field of second language acquisition. He's taught English and trained teachers all around the world, but in Indonesia, Thailand, the United States, Finland, and
Japan.
Here in Japan.
And he's in New Zealand now. He's always been attached to the same university in Wellington in New Zealand. That would be the School of Linguistics and Applied Language Studies at Victoria University of Wellington. And he's published and researched a lot on vocabulary learning and on language teaching methodology.
Yeah, and perhaps you're familiar with his well-known four strands approach to language teaching. And we'll address that here in this interview. So,
welcome.
Welcome, Professor Nation.
Hello.
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 All right, good.
Can you hear us?
Yeah. Yep, loud and clear.
Wonderful. We'll get started then.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
All right.
So I've just finished my master's degree at Temple University here in Osaka.
Oh yeah, I'll be there in about 4 months, I think.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
But what I was getting at, so I've read a few of your books for class, and they all start with an explanation of the four strands. And I think maybe a good place and a natural place for the beginning of our interview would just to be a brief start on what are an overview on what the four strands are.
Okay. Well, I came to the idea of the four strands because I'd been reading a lot of research about language learning and language teaching. You know, Steve Krashen was writing about the importance of input. Others were writing about deliberate learning and so on. And I wanted to see how it all fitted together because, you know, you read about listening and you read about speaking and all of this sort of stuff. And I'd also been engaged in research on fluency development and so on, but there was never any way I could see. I hadn't even thought of how do you draw all of these different areas of research together. And so I sort of fiddled around, and then I came up with the idea of the four strands. And the main idea, it's just a very simple curriculum design idea. Mm-hmm. But it has very important implications. And it's really trying to fit all the practical research on teaching and learning foreign languages together under one sort of principle. And the basic principle says that if you want to have a well-balanced language course covering the four skills, you need to have four equally balanced strands. And then the first strand is learning from input. Mm-hmm. And input includes listening and reading. And it has to be genuine listening and reading, not the teacher handing out a comprehension passage and then multiple choice questions or doing grammar translation on the passage. That's not meaning-focused input. It has to be genuine reading as an extensive reading, and it has to be genuine listening as an extensive listening. Mm. And that makes up one strand and should make up roughly about one quarter of the course time. And the course time includes what happens in class and what happens outside class in terms of getting input. The second strand is the strand of output. I disagree with Steve Krashen on this. Steve has argued in the past that, you know, input's all you need. And that's clearly ridiculous because, you know, how do you speak without learning to make the sounds of the language? And you don't learn to make the sounds of the language without having a go at saying them, you know. And there's no doubt that input's important for learning to speak, but the trouble is it only provides part of the information you need. And so the second strand is learning through output, and that's through speaking and writing. The third strand is a deliberate learning strand. And this one, surprisingly, is a little bit controversial, although to me it's not controversial. And that simply says, if you want to learn efficiently, then you need to spend about a quarter of your time doing deliberate study of a whole variety of features of the language. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth strand is the strand of fluency development. And fluency development simply involves getting good at using what you already know. So not learning new language features, but actually getting really good and fluent at using the features you already know. And the fluency strand has to be divided into listening, speaking, reading, and writing, because there's plenty of evidence to show that focus on a particular skill for fluency is a very efficient way of developing fluency. So that's really all that the strands, all that the principle of the strands is. But when you look at the implications of it, the most important implication, I think, is that teaching, where the teacher gets up and explains things and deals with language features and all of, you know, and is leading the class, is really only a very small part of a well-balanced language course, or should be only a small part.
Sure.
So teaching really, in the narrow sense that I'm using it, only occurs in the language-focused learning strand, and it only occurs in part of the language-focused learning strand, because the other parts of the language-focused learning strand are where the learners do deliberate study without a teacher and do their own learning. And I think one of the big problems of language classes in Japan, for example, is that there's far too much teaching and not enough learning going on and not enough language use going on.
Absolutely.
And teachers find it really difficult to get the idea that learning can occur without teaching. And they're also, teachers tend to be conscientious, and they also feel that if they don't teach, then they're not really doing their job. But in my ideal course, the teacher actually fronting up the class and being the source of knowledge and information should probably only make up about 1/16, 1/8 at the most of the course time. But it's a brave teacher who then says, you know, about 3/16 of my course time is going to be on extensive reading, where I sit down and I read a book, or I get on with marking and I just let the learners choose any book they want to read at the right level, and then they just read it. They feel guilty about that. But there are some places in Japan which have bit that bullet and are actually doing really good things with that. So that's one of the main implications of the four strands, is that teaching then should be seen as playing an only a relatively small but important role in the learning of a language.
Thanks for that. maybe we should be redefining the role of the teacher, not only as a source of knowledge, but as an enabler, maybe.
Facilitator, right?
The book that I've written that I feel the happiest about, when I wrote the book, I thought, gee, this is good. I did a good job on this. That book is the one called What Should Every EFL Teacher Know? And that, at the beginning, spells out about four roles for the teacher, but I thought of a fifth one since then, but that's life. But it sees that, you know, the number one role of the teacher is the teacher as a planner, you know, where the teacher says, how do I get a balance of learning opportunities across four strands? You know, how do I make sure that learners are focusing on the material, which is the right at the right level for them at this time in their language proficiency thing? And then the second job of the teacher is to be the organizer. You know, how do I organize an extensive reading program that really works, you know, that turns on the students, that gets them reading, you know, hundreds of thousands of words per year, and so on. And then you can move down the jobs, you know, and the last job, the number four or five job, is the teacher actually teaches. When I make a list, I quite like to prioritize things, because it's okay to list things, but if they are of different importance, then I think you should put the most important one first and make some decision about it. And so that's why I put the teacher as planner and organizer way up the top of the teacher's jobs.
Do you think that, like, the students' perceptions of learning are an important factor in that too? If I feel like, especially here in Japan, like, the teacher's role is, they're seen as this, like, purveyor of information, and there's not learning if it doesn't come from the teacher.
Yeah, I think teachers' perceptions are right, but I don't think you have to accept them.
Yeah.
I tend to be very prescriptive. As a teacher, I say, look, I've been studying this field for well over 50 years. I reckon I know better about what you should be doing than you do.
Yeah.
You know, now, having said that, I also recognize that just about every PhD student I've had have proved me wrong. You know, they start out with a question, and I thought the answer was going to go a certain way, and it turned out often go a very surprising way. So you better not put too much credence on what I say. But still, I think that, you know, students might want to see the teacher as a thing, but as a purveyor of information. But the teacher's job, I think, is to say, look, there are more useful things that you should be doing and that the teacher should be doing. Now, you know, in Japan, one of the places I got the biggest kick out of going to see was the SEG language schools in Shinjuku.
Yeah.
There's a guy called Akio Furukawa who's got a juku there, and he, for 3 hours of class, a student come 3 hours a week after their school, you know, secondary school classes, and their parents are paying lots of money. And they're coming for, you know, every week plus some extra classes in the break time. And for half of the 3 hours, they simply sit and do extensive reading where the teacher doesn't do a scrap to do it. Now, I said, I don't believe that this is happening. You know, why would the parents pay all this money, and why would the students just sit there quietly for an hour and a half every week and just do extensive reading? So I went to see. And that's exactly what they're doing. And some of them, not a big number of them, actually choose to do 3 hours extensive reading instead of an hour and a half.
Wow.
And then what he did what he did during the class. He said, at the end of it, he said, look, I'm going to ask some questions, you watch. And he said, do you like doing extensive reading? And everyone said, yeah, and of course they'll say, yeah, you know, they're there. So, you know, you could say, well, anyway. And then he said, would you do this at home? And about maybe less than a quarter put up their hand. And their response was, we're just too busy when we're at home. There are too many things we have to do. We haven't got time to do that. And after the class, I got talking to some of them. And they really do enjoy the extensive reading. They think it's great. And the reason the parents continue to pay the fees is because they do well in the entrance exams to university. And sure, their scores on the entrance exams are higher, way higher than the national average. Mm-hmm. And so he's a very modest, unassuming guy, but who's read the research. And he's managed to get these people to do what other teachers should be doing. And yeah, it's no magic. He just, yeah, it's here's a time, you do it, and so on. So, you know, yeah, it's interesting to know what students think, but I don't think that you have to satisfy them by going by what they want. I think you've got to say, look, the research shows this. You might not like it, but my responsibility as a teacher is to teach and or to provide the opportunities for learning in the way I think best. So I tend to be a bit prescriptive.
Good. Well, thank you.
I'm going to be a pain in the neck. In Akio Furukawa's model, extensive reading is occupying like half the time. And from the point of view of the four strands, wouldn't this be really unbalanced?
Yeah. What he does in the other half of the time is to have interaction with a native speaker in a rather small group. And so they're doing, I think, sort of listening and speaking. But I didn't observe that part of the class. But I imagine it's fairly natural kind of interaction between, you know, a native speaker and the students, that they're actually talking and carrying on like that to each other. It's not a balance, but he's only got 3 hours a week and they've got all their other English courses. So they don't need language-focused learning strand. They're getting that in their normal courses anyway. What I would do in Akio school is I would run a reading fluency course. And a reading fluency course only it's 20 passages, takes about 7 or 8 minutes per passage. You read the passage, you know, note the time, answer the questions, mark the questions yourself, and then enter your speed and your comprehension score onto graphs. Because research shows that this focused kind of reading fluency course is much more efficient at developing fluency than just doing extensive reading. There's a couple of pieces of research. David Begler's done one of the pieces of research with David Allen Hunt and Hunt, someone, yeah, Kite. Yeah, yeah. And they showed an increase, but the increase that they showed was good, but it was nowhere near the increase you can get in a focused fluency course. Mm. And so I would add that fluency course if I was Akio, because it only occupies a few minutes of each session, you know, 7 or 8 minutes of each session. You only have to do it about 20 times, and most learners will increase their reading speed by 50%, and many will double their reading speed. And because you do that, then, you know, they can read more. They can read 50% more or 100% more in the same time. So so from a four strands perspective, I would say that's not happening at the secondary school. So he should be putting that in too. Mm. Yeah.
Could you give us some more information on how this focused fluency course would be like, and the rationale? I mean, the reason why that would contribute to fluency more than extensive reading would.
I can answer the first question, but I can't answer the second one. And it's not because of a secret. It's just that I don't really know. All it is you go to Sonia Millett's website. Sonia is S-O-N-I-A, and Millett is M-I-L-L-E-T-T. And she's got a whole pile of free speed reading courses that you can download.
Oh, wow.
And they start at the 500-word level. She's got one at the 1,000-word level. She's got one at the 2,000-word level. She's got one at 2,000 plus academic word list, one at the 3,000 level. She's got a whole pile. And these courses are very carefully written within a controlled vocabulary. And so you choose the course where your learners will know every word in the course you've chosen, or almost every word, before they do the course. Okay, so if you've got learners who know about 700-800 words, you choose a 500-level course. If you've got students who know 1,200-1,300 words, you choose a 1,000-level course. But, you know, going even lower doesn't hurt. And then all that happens is that the teacher says, okay, speed reading, and what the teacher provides is photocopies of these passages with the passage on one side, questions on the other. And then they have their conversion chart, which converts time into words per minute. Every passage is exactly the same length.
Okay.
And so the conversion chart's very simple. And then they have their graphs, which is their speed graph and their comprehension graph. And the teacher says, okay, everyone got their passage? You know, you haven't read this passage before? Good. Are you ready? Go. And then if you're a technological wizard, you put up countdown.
Yeah.
Not a countdown. You put up stopwatch up on, you know, project a stopwatch. And then when someone finishes reading the passage, they look up and note down the time that appears on the stopwatch. And then they turn the page, 10 comprehension questions. They go through quickly, you know, B, C, D. They're multiple choice. And the questions are deliberately easy. There's no tricky questions. Even if you don't read the passage, you'll get about 50% correct, and that's deliberate. But the best score is about 7 out of 10. If someone's scoring 10 out of 10, the teacher would look at that result when walking around after they've done the reading and say, oh, you got 10 out of 10. You're reading far too slowly. If you're getting that level of comprehension, you should be going faster, because for this kind of text, you only need 7 or 8 out of 10. And if you're getting 4 or 5 out of 10, you're saying, well, next time, don't try to read faster. Just try and read the same speed until your comprehension score comes up. And so they read the passages in random order. Each student doesn't have to have a copy of the book. You just, you know, 20 passages there. If you've got 40 or 30 students in your class, you make two copies of each passage. And as they read a passage, they tick off the number, you know, of the passage they've read. So, and you can get people to reread passages if they get very low comprehension scores or so on. But after about, you know, the first two lessons of this, the first lesson would take about 15 or 20 minutes, because you've got to explain what they do. And, you know, and then when you finish, note the time and then answer questions, then get the answer sheet. You know, there's a whole pile of answer sheets circulating. You mark your answers yourself, and then you put them on your thing. If you want to cheat, go ahead. Who cares? You know, you're only mucking it up for yourself. And then once you're into this, it only takes, you know, 7 or 8 minutes, because it takes about, the passages around about 500 words. So it takes about 3 to 1.5 minutes to read a passage. And then they just got to do the comprehension questions, put the stuff on their graph, and then they're on with their extensive reading.
So I'd do it in class. Like a regular activity that you could do every class.
Yeah, you could do it 2 or 3 times a week. One of my PhD students, you know, looked to see, does it make a difference if you do it once a week compared to 3 times a week compared to that? She found no difference.
Oh, but wow.
my prejudice would be, you know, once a week is stringing it out a bit. I'd want, you know, the gains to carry over and so on. And so it's very simple to do and very effective. And, you know, the research has been, there's quite a few pieces of research now. You find some on my website, Chung and Nation 2004 or 5, I think, maybe 2006. That's one report of one done in Korea. Tran Yen, I guess. She published in the Rock Journal, of her PhD research on speed reading and so on. People have looked to see whether it transfers outside the course to other reading finds, and they find that it does. You know, it's pretty well researched. Now, why does it work? That was your second question.
Yeah, what's the rationale behind it?
This is something I puzzle over, because if you said to me, okay, in 20 passages, say 7 minutes each, that's 140 minutes, you know, from a couple of hours practice, I'm going to double your reading speed. I'd say, you know, pull the other leg, you know, you're dreaming.
Right.
But the trouble is, the results show that that's what happens. So, you know, it's almost too good to be true. And I've tried to figure out, you know, what happens when fluency develops. And the best thing that I can get at is similar to an explanation by De Jong and Perfetti in an article in Language Learning, where they looked at fluency development in speaking using 4-3-2. Their theory was that the really frequent words of the language become processed much faster.
Yeah,
automatized. And those frequent words make up something like 90% or so of any text you're going to produce or any text you're going to read and so on. I also think there's some sort of systematic element too, in the sense that you get good at seeing words as words, and perhaps you start to develop some tendency to look for phrases rather than words. Although when we read, we actually pay attention to almost every word. We focus on almost on 90% of the words we read, even when we read quite fast. But, you know, from a repetition perspective, it's a bit hard, because half of the words in any text occur only once. And so if you regarded the whole speed reading course as a text, which is quite a reasonable thing to do, half of the different words in that course are only going to occur once. So you can't explain, you know, the increase solely on repetition of vocabulary, you know, and things like that. And so I think there must be some system element of getting used to letter combinations and word combinations as well. My belief, which is completely unresearched, is that fluency development is probably a major way in which knowledge of collocations develop. Because when you develop fluency, you're forced eventually to work with a larger unit than you normally work with. You know, if you're reading at the letter level, then when you do speed reading, you'll start to read at the syllable or word level, and you've got to really change your unit. And when you get really fast, then maybe you're working more at the phrase level than at the word level, you know. Not focusing on phrases, but being able to predict phrases, you know, and things like that. So I have a feeling that extensive reading and fluency development would do a lot for collocational knowledge.
Great, thanks. We've kind of danced around it already. So would extensive reading solely fit into fluency development? Or, I mean, surely it's also like a meaning-focused input kind of activity, right?
Well, this is. I said that the first major implication of the four strands is that it has something to say about the role of teaching. I think the second major implication of the four strands is that it helps you work out how much you should be doing of certain activities and certain things, and in what way you should be doing it. And so, when I have to teach about the four strands, I say, look, at the end of this class, a three-hour class at Temple University perhaps, by the end of the class, you should be able to answer questions like this. How do you teach grammar? How do you teach writing? How do you teach reading? How do you teach pronunciation? So at the end of the class, you'll be able to answer all of those questions. And the way you answer all of those questions is say, well, how do you do extensive reading? Okay, how should you carry out extensive reading? Okay, where does extensive reading fit in the four strands? Okay, so then you say, well, it's meaning-focused input. And, of course, it's got to share that with listening, so it must be about half of meaning-focused input. So that makes about an eighth of the time in a course for extensive reading. But extensive reading can also, if it's done with easy texts, can also result in fluency development. Now, the big finding of the Begler, Hunt and Kite study was that the students who increased their fluency the most were not just the students who read the most, but they were the students who read the most graded readers.
The easier that texts, right?
Yeah, who read the texts which were at the right level for them. And so if you look at the fluency strand, then one quarter of the fluency strand is reading. And so how then would you develop fluency in reading? Well, you have a speed reading course, but you also use the rest of that 1/16th of the total course time, because it's one quarter of one strand. You spend that other 16th doing easy extensive reading. So that means you've got 1/8 of the course on extensive reading, which is meaning-focused input, where you're meeting some new words, but not too many, and you're meeting some new constructions and having to deal with them. It's quite interesting for me because I'm just getting to the point, I've been trying to learn to read Thai for the last year or so, and I'm just getting to the point now where I'm moving from language-focused learning to meaning-focused input. Now, I try to do about 20 minutes each day or something like that, and I've been slacking off a bit over the last few months. But when I started off, I kept pretty closely to that. But I'm now at the point where I think that, you know, I pick up a text, then I can read it and read a few sentences and lines, and then I'll come across a word I don't know, and I'll have to look it up or have a guess or something. But I can just feel now I'm just at that point of moving from language-focused learning to meaning-focused input. And the reason it's taken me so long is that there are no graded readers in Thai. I'm reading the books that young Thai kids 30 years ago used to learn when they began to read Thai. And they're really good. They're beautifully written books. They're all about Thai life, and they're trying to make the students love their country and respect the monks and respect their parents and do work around the home. They're all very moral and everything, but they're really a good slice of Thai life, you know. But they're tough because they're not under vocab control. And so, you know, so you say, well, how do you teach extensive reading? Well, you say, well, it involves meaning-focused input. It involves fluency development. Do you think language-focused learning has anything to do with extensive reading? What's the relationship between language-focused learning and extensive reading? And I think part of the answer to that is, well, if you meet new words and if you're reading graded readers, you should be putting those useful words onto word cards and doing a bit of deliberate learning as well to make sure that, you know, you can move, you know, more readily through the levels of extensive reading. And what about output? What role should output play in an extensive reading course? And you'd say, well, yeah, I mean, if you talk about things that you've already read about, then you bring background knowledge to what you're doing.
Yeah.
And so part of the extensive reading course shouldn't really be speaking, but it would be really great to link the extensive reading course to later speaking activities. You know, so when you say, how do you teach extensive reading, you have to say, well, where does it fit in the four strands? And what does this mean about what proportion of time we give to it? And then how does it relate to other aspects? You know?
Yeah, and I think really, I mean, in terms of speaking activities, drawing from information from reading can really enrich those other activities, right? So the things that you do in the reading can... bring those other things to life.
Yeah. Well, New Zealand used to be quite famous for the teaching of reading. And there was a pioneer called Sylvia Ashton Warner who taught Maori kids up the east coast of the North Island years and years ago. She wrote a book about how she did the teaching. And what she did was she didn't use the school books. When these little kids came to school, she'd say, okay, I want you to draw a picture of what happened at your place or what happened to you during the weekend. And these little kids would get down, little five-year-olds, get down, draw a picture. And then one by one, they'd bring their picture up to the teacher, and she'd say, oh, good, what's your picture? Oh, you've got it upside down. Oh, okay, turn it right way up, have a look. And he said, oh, yesterday my daddy drove the truck out of the drive and ran over the dog and killed it. And that red spot in the picture is the dog, you see. And so what she would do in her teacherly, best teacherly hand printing, she would then write, yesterday my daddy drove the truck out of the drive and ran over the dog and killed it. And she'd write that, you know, in beautiful script under the picture. And she'd say, that's your reading text for the day. You go and read it to your mates. And then if you're brave, take it home and read it to your parents, you know. and over the days, they build up their reading books, which come from their own experience, you see. So everything that they're reading, they already know about through previous experience. And so this was called an experience approach to reading. And it worked well, of course, because the only thing that the learners had to do was not learn new vocabulary. These are young native speakers. Not learn new vocabulary or grammar. Not learn new concepts or ideas. They simply learn, how do I turn print into sound? You know, they learn to read. And they're doing this on the basis of experience. So this idea then of linking extensive reading to speaking and so on is in some way doing the same thing. It's trying to turn speaking not into a challenging task, but into an experience task where you draw on what you already know, mm-hmm. and then do the difficult thing of speaking about it. You know, mm-hmm. So it's a well-honored sort of teaching type of teaching technique, and you know, an experience approach.
Thank you, Professor Nation. That was wonderful. That'll be the first part of our interview. We'll do it two parts, as we do with these longer interviews, so you can look forward to hearing part two next week. Yep. But I really enjoyed that. I appreciate him giving us the overview of the four strands and then introducing speed reading, which is something I've never done in class before.
Yeah, I never considered like extensive reading like in as a source of as a tool for fluency development, kind of separately from, I mean, separating meaning focused input and then fluency development. I would just think of both
as acquisition
going together. Yeah, as acquisition. Right. Yeah. It's a nice analytical tool.
Yeah.
To have that separation. And yeah, we are leaving, if you go to the show notes for this episode, there'll be a link to Sonia Millett's website that Professor Nation mentioned.
With all the different resources for the speed reading program he introduced. There'll be a few other links too. What are those?
We have the book that Professor Nation mentioned he's proud of.
his crowning achievement, right?
Yeah. It's very nice to hear somebody say that they are so happy about their own book, because I know that people who write books are not always happy with the result, and it was very nice to me personally.
Yeah, and the title of that is What Every EFL, ESL? What Should Every EFL Teacher Know?
Mm-hmm.
We'll have a link to that.
And then, yeah, Professor Nation also mentioned Akio Furukawa's Joku, SEG, in Tokyo. And we live in two links. One of them is a review of a visit to, an account of a visit to this Joku by Ben Sheeran. And then there's a first-person account of how it works by Akio Furukawa himself. And what else? More on speed reading by Professor Nation and Chung, mm-hmm. from 2006. And also the Jong and Perfetti.
Their 432 study that, mm-hmm. he mentioned. And then finally the article he mentioned by Begler, Hunt, and Kite.
And that'll be all for the links.
Yeah, you can find that in our show notes. So
yeah, just go to erpodcast.wordpress.com and yeah, it'll be there. If you don't want to go to the website, you can also download the episode thanks to Travis's work.
Yeah, through any podcast application. Just search us at Extensive Reading Podcast and we should show up.
Okay, so
next week, hope you join us again for the second part of that interview. And until then, Happy reading.